All right, now today we are going to be looking at the issues or principles of faith, and as we're getting to Hebrews chapter 11, that great Hall of Faith chapter, and talks about all those different people who had faith and what the faith was about and those things. And but I want, as we get to that and begin to progress through that passage, I want you to be also thinking about what we've also looked at in Hebrews up to this point. And in particular, Hebrews is a book of encouragement. It's all about keeping on and moving forward and getting through and not turning back. But the underlying theme of all of that encouragement is the fact that is the superiority of Christ, right? And so what I want to try to do is to kind of weave those two thoughts together, because while he's been encouraging us, he's also been telling us about how great Christ is. And those two don't necessarily just inherently, I don't know that you necessarily think, oh, Christ is great, that encourages me. I mean, it should, but there's a reason for that. And so I want you to kind of be thinking about that ultimately Christ is superior in these many different ways we've already looked at, and there's something that relates that, faith to that, and how faith and the superiority of Christ go together ultimately to bring this encouragement about to us. So just let that kind of be ruminating through your mind as we begin our look at this. Now, in order to get to Hebrews 11, of course, we have to kind of get the end of Hebrews 10 and jump right into it. And we looked at this last couple weeks about being made new. Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is through his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith. And this is where he transitions now into this full discussion of faith. The most prolific use of the word faith in the Bible is coming up in chapter 11. And he introduces us to this topic, if you will, by letting us know about Christ. So that kind of gives you an idea of where I'm heading with this thing in terms of the superiority of Christ and how the faith enters into that. So that we see right off the bat that we are able to enter into this holiest place, the Holy of Holies, and by this new and living way, because of how great Christ is and what he did for us. As a result of that ability, because we can enter in, because of what Christ did for us, we should therefore draw near. And we draw near with a true heart, how? In full assurance of faith. So while Christ did everything that was necessary for us to be able to enter in, there's still the requirement for us to have that faith. And it's not just that initial faith that we enter into with that relationship with Christ, that saving relationship, the saving faith, but is that ongoing, continuous action of faith that we have on a daily basis. And that is having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed. This is kind of continuously, if you will, and let us hold fast, continue on in that hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Now, ultimately, what we're getting to is this. Christ is superior. Christ is faithful, therefore we can have faith in this faithful one. Because there always has to be an object of faith, remember? Now we spent a couple weeks looking at just defining what faith is early on in this series. Now, can anyone give me the definition of faith as I gave it? Anyone remember my definition of faith? Anyone want to take a stab at it? All right, that's a key parts of it. Faith is a belief in the person and the promises. Okay, good. Anybody else remember anything else? Well, that's a good starting point. We'll leave it at that for now. So we have the person, we have the promise, but the key in this thing is that there is some specific target of this faith. I don't know how this came about, but at some point in time, or maybe it's always been this way, but there's just this idea when you start to talk about faith, and you look at And, you know, there are many faiths out there, and everyone has faith, and you know, you could be of the Jewish faith, and you can be of the Muslim faith, and you can be of the Hindu faith, and what does that mean? What's the common denominator? Well, the common denominator is you believe in something, as opposed to maybe an atheist, I guess, who doesn't have faith. But they have their own faith, of course, in their own ways. But that's another story. But just that general notion of faith doesn't really get us to the point we're trying to get to, and that is you really have to have faith in something specific, and that's the key here, and then ultimately in the person who's able to fulfill that promise. And that's why he says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, because he who promised is faithful. He is the one who can deliver this thing to us. So we are made new by this new and living way, and we are, in a sense, renewed by that daily faith. It's a continuous action that keeps us in that newness, if you will. And he goes on to talk about how someone who rejected the law of Moses was put to death without mercy, and how much greater punishment do you think that person deserves who has contempt for the Son of God, profanes the blood of the covenant that made him holy, and insults the Spirit of grace. And for we know this one who said, vengeance is mine, and it's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Contempt for the Son, profanity of the blood, and insult of the Spirit in its context is what? What really, if you could say, all three of these things is really a result of or not doing something, according to the context of what we've already seen. What's that? Rejecting? Okay. Unbelief. I think that's the most succinct way of saying it. It's not having faith. He's going into this discussion now. Remember, he says, "Enter in. You have the way. You can enter into the holiest." Let me go back here. You can enter into the holiest. You have that entrance now. Let us draw near. And then he says, "Therefore, or someone who rejected the law of Moses, contempt, profane, and insults the Spirit of grace." What he's saying is, you don't have faith, because the very next thing he goes on to talk about now is going to be chapter 11, or a little bit more, but then chapter 11, faith, 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 faith. So he says, faith is how you do this thing, and then rejection, and then more about the faith. The whole point of the rejection is not just some specific sin it's ultimately rooted in this thing of not having faith. And this is how we reject. This is how we have contempt. This is how we profane. This is how we insult the Spirit of grace, is not living by faith. Why? Because he's given us everything we need to live by faith. He's given us a clear example of the superiority of Christ and that he is faithful. And so when he says, this one, he did this, he did that, he did this, and he's so superior in all these ways, you can believe in him. Now think about it. Could you believe the God of the Old Testament? Same God, I know, but I'm just using that terminology. Could you believe God just by viewing what is said in the Old Testament? Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's all of his examples are from the Old Testament in Hebrews 11. So clearly that is sufficient for us to see what he's done. But how much better is... Boy, this is a bad way of saying it. How much better is the God of the New Testament? No, I take that back. How much better is what he shows us through his Son in the New Testament is superior to all those examples in the Old Testament? If you can believe those in the Old Testament, you can certainly believe his Son, and you see the superiority. We should definitely not have contempt for, profane, and insult the Spirit of grace. But remember the former days when you endured a harsh conflict with suffering. And right before that it said, it is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. So, here's the thing of faith. He says, now remember though, you know, if you don't have faith, this is not a good thing. There's contempt and all that. But, on the other hand, remember. So here's the whole point of this thing. You can have faith, and sometimes in order to have faith, you've got to remember the way you did succeed previously. Remember the former days when you endured a harsh conflict of suffering and you shared the sufferings of those in prison, etc. Success that came by looking to the future. So sometimes you remember the successes, and the last phrase is because you knew that you certainly had a better and lasting possession. This is an interesting case that he's making. He says, look, don't not have faith. Do have faith just like you used to. Remember, he's talking to people, the Hebrews, who are contemplating perhaps rejection of their new life and going back to the old and all that. He says, but remember, you guys have gotten through tough times. You have done it. And how did you get through those tough times? You knew that you certainly had a better and lasting possession. So you got through the tough times in the past by looking to the future. And how are you going to get through the tough times again? Ultimately, by looking to the future. And that doesn't mean that we just live just for the future. He gives us a life for right now, and the peace and all that we can have right now as we're going through it. But ultimately, if this is it, if the joy and the peace that he has for us now is it, and you have no future, it's probably not going to be sufficient for you. It's not going to be sufficient for me, anyhow. I don't know about you. Now, I got to practice this, and I failed this week. I had kind of a long week, and I wanted to get home on Friday, and I was leaving a little bit later, and I wanted to on Friday. So I'm coming home, it's rainy, and it's cold. I get in my car, and I get on 35, and it was some of the worst traffic I've ever been in. I do this little trick where I get off the highway at 6th Street, and then I go through the lights there, and I get back on the highway, because usually it's a little faster. Anyhow, so I do my little trick, but it didn't work this time, because no one was getting on the highway. It was so backed up, and I'm on between 7th and 5th Street, wherever those are, downtown for 45 minutes just to get back on the highway. I finally get on, and then I hear on the radio that there's an accident at Riverside, and I'm like, oh man, so I got to get past that. I just get past the accident at Riverside, and I'm starting to speed up, but my car is not speeding up. And it's making this funny noise. Like, what is that? And the more I try to speed up, the more it's not speeding up. And then I'll thump, 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 like that. So I got a flat tire. I'm in the middle lane. I can't get over because there's a new ramp. There's a ramp right there. It's raining out. I've turned the blinkers on. I got the hazards on, And then when you got the hazards on, no one knows you're trying to get over because the hazard is your blinker. And no one's letting me over. And I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And then I finally get over on the shoulder. And I get out to go change the tire. And I get my spare tire out, and it's got some air, and I'm thinking, oh, this is good. So I get out there, and I find the jack, and I've never jacked up this car, and it's got a funky thing. But I found it, and I'm starting to jack it up. And then I go to get the lug nuts off, and there's no lug wrench there's no tire iron in my trunk. And I was like, oh, I was really mad. And all that story to tell you that I did not have the joy of thanking God for my situation that day. But finally, Papa Lot came out and got me all set up, and I got on my way home 3 hours later. So it was all good. It was all good. But now I can look to the future and know that I have a better and lasting possession ahead of me despite my circumstances. So do not throw away your confidence, which I did on Friday. Because it has great reward, for you need endurance in order to do God's will and so receive what is promised. Now, seriously, though, I do have, there's a certain struggles that you experience in life, and some of those is just requires you to have endurance. To think through, I know I can get through this. I know I can do it because God has not given me anything that I'm not able to handle. And that's endurance, is to thinking through that. And sometimes you feel like I can't do it. Just endure is what he tells us to do. For a little while longer, and he who is coming will arrive and not delay. But my righteous one, or the just one, will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I have no pleasure in him. But we are not among those who shrink back. So here he's going full-fledged into this thing of faith now. Don't throw away the confidence. Remember, you need endurance. And the just shall live by faith, and he's going to go full-fledged into this thing of faith. But first, I want to spend a little bit of time on this phrase. We've seen it before. I want to do it again because it's good to remember this. One of my favorite passages of all is where he quotes us from. But my just, or the just shall live by faith, is how we usually see it in the New King James. Now that phrase, the just shall live by faith, is quoted 3 times in the New Testament. If it's not the most quoted Old Testament single passage, it is one of them. And it's quoted here in Hebrews that we just saw. It's quoted in Romans, and it's quoted in Galatians. Now, before we look at those passages, I want to refresh your memory about what Habakkuk is all about. In Habakkuk, Habakkuk chapter 1, the prophet is looking at the destruction of Jerusalem, the coming destruction of Judah, and all that's happening there and the bad things that are occurring, and he's crying out to God. God, you've got to deliver us. Remember how you promised you were going to do great things, and this is terrible, and it's your place, and it's your people, and you don't want to look bad, right, God? So you got to do this thing. That's really what he's saying. And he says, I know you're going to do this, God. And God comes back and says, Habakkuk, it's actually going to get worse before it gets better. And then Habakkuk says, well, yeah, but God, what about this? And God comes back and says, Habakkuk, let me tell you, it's going to get much worse. But, despite the fact that you can't see anything positive or good or wonderful or great or holy or anything out of this thing, you shall live by faith. And what I love about the book Habakkuk is it's short, for one. But secondly, I'm honest. And secondly, you get to chapter 4 and Habakkuk gets it finally. He really gets it. He says there, you know, the tree may wither and there may not have no water and there may not be the fields may not produce produce, but yet I shall trust in my God. And you see that he has really finally figured it out. And that's the story for us. We're to live in that thing of faith. Now, there's no accident that he's quoted that three times for us. And so let's look at those the context of those three quotes in the New Testament. In Romans 1, he goes into that's the introduction for Romans. You recall the lengthy way for Paul to say hi. Now, and then followed by this, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is God's power, the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel from faith to faith, just as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Right? And for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of people who suppress the truth by their unrighteousness. Now, we usually kind of separate out 17 from 18 because 18, and rightfully so, 18 kind of introduces the next topic that he's bringing out for us. And that is, you recall from the study in the walkthrough about how he goes into a lengthy thing about how if you have a little bit of knowledge and you suppress that, you get a little bit of wrath, so to speak. And if you have a lot of knowledge, you suppress that, you get a lot of wrath. You recall that? And so that's, we kind of break that thing out. So we talk about how 17 is a summary of the book of Romans, and it accurately does that. The book of Romans can be broken down into you are saved by faith, and that's how you become just or righteous, and you live by faith, right? But you can't completely separate them out either, because it's a continuation of thought. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, as opposed to the just living by faith. So there's a contrast there. If you are righteous, you should live that way by faith continuously, and the opposite of that is the wrath of God coming on those who you could summarize just by saying don't live by faith. They get some knowledge of God, and as opposed to accepting it and living by that, they reject it for whatever reason. We all have our own reasons for rejecting God's word in our own lives and not living by faith. And wrath comes to us as a result of that. It may not be wrath in terms of, you know, going to hell, but it's wrath in our own lives that we experience on a daily basis as well. So I would summarize it this way in terms of a relationship with faith, is that he says live by faith. Or you could even change that to an F and say life is by faith, and that is true life comes by faith, right? But you also live continuously by faith. So you might say this, it's faith versus the suppression of truth, or even just faith versus wrath. So you have faith. If you don't have faith, you don't live by faith, there's some wrath that comes as a result of that, we could say, right? Now Galatians then uses that passage as well. And in Galatians, he uses it with a little bit different flavor or emphasis. Just as Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness, so then understand that those who believe are the sons of Abraham. And the scriptures foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, proclaiming the gospel to Abraham ahead of time, saying, all the nations will be blessed in you. So then those who believe are blessed along with Abraham the believer. For all who rely on doing the works of the law are under a curse, because it's written, curses everyone who does not keep everything written in the book of the law. So there's a contrast between believing and trying to have getting your righteousness by keeping the law. So it's faith versus law. Or you could even say faith versus a curse, because if you're trying to get your righteousness by the law, you can't keep the law. That's going to bring a curse, right? So just by a summary, you could say it's faith versus a curse. And then he goes on to say, "Now it's clear to me, or now it is clear, no one is justified before God by the law, because the righteous one or the just shall live by faith." So his point in this specific quote is more salvific. That's a real word, by the way. It's more salvific than it is progressive. That's his emphasis, is you gain righteousness, you get righteousness by this faith, as opposed to Romans, more of the emphasis was on living it as opposed to just getting it, although both of them are in there. But the law is not based on faith, but the one who does the works of the law will live by them. Christ redeemed us from this curse. Curses everyone who hangs on the tree. In order that in Christ the blessing of Abraham would come, so that we could receive the promise of the Spirit by faith. So this issue of faith then in Galatians is faith versus law, faith versus curse, or you could even say faith versus death, right? It's how you really come to life in this thing, as opposed to through the law. And then what we saw in Hebrews is that there's a need for endurance, that faith is required, and that there is an encouragement to keep this thing up. So it is ultimately faith versus failure in the book of Hebrews. So I would say it's faith versus wrath, faith versus death, and faith versus failure. And by failure, I don't mean, boy, you're a rotten failure. I mean, God wants us to continue on in that life and to live in success as a Christian life. So that's what I mean by faith versus failure. So all three of these elements come out and are emphasized through that one quote. So faith is opposite. What we're trying to do here now is trying to summarize as we go along what we can learn about faith through the book of Hebrews. And so far we've seen this. Faith is opposite failure. It's opposite death. It's opposite wrath from all three of those passages. Faith is enduring. It is hanging on. He says, remember, endure. Keep going on. And ultimately, God is not pleased with unfaithfulness or the unfaithful or just plain unfaith. He says, you know, there is wrath that comes upon, and certainly if there was wrath for not obeying Moses' law, how about those who reject Christ and all of that? So there's certainly an unpleased, maybe the understatement of the year, but we'll leave it at that, because I want to be pleasant this morning. So now he goes on to the specific discussions of faith. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for. It is the evidence of things not seen, for by it the elders obtained a good testimony. Now, this is a loaded phrase here, by the way, substance of things hoped for. And this is, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about that one word, because I found this quite fascinating. I didn't know this before this week, and so this is new information for me as well. The word substance is translated variously in the different translations. I bring it up here for you so that you can see that there's kind of two different ways that it shows itself. There is King James is substance, and there's also this thing of assurance or being sure or guarantee or full confidence. And so you see how there's all the different translations, but there's two main themes that come out, either substance or confidence assurance. Now, those are kind of different, aren't they? I mean, if I said, hey, that's really substantial, or I say, I have confidence in that, there's a lot of difference between those two statements. So which one is it? Well, what we're going to see is that there's a reason that there's a lot of difference. The word substance that's translated for us has many different aspects. One of them is this: the essential or basic structure or nature of an entity. And it's translated in this way: substantial nature, essence, actual being, reality. It's used in this way of the Son of God as an exact representation, and it's used of things. This is where English kind of fails us. Not really fails us, but it's where our modern English fails us, because the word substance has a root in English as well that really we don't use that way anymore. If you really, maybe a better word for it in this sense would be substrate. Now, I'm not sure exactly what a substrate is, but I know it has something to do with the foundation of a building, all right? And that's about all I know about it. But that's kind of the idea of this word for substance, and that is there's a foundation or something underneath it that allows it to stand firm. That's where this idea of substance in English came from, and that's why they translated this. King James folks back in 1611 translated it this way, because that was kind of the notion that they were thinking of. Something that is really substantial, that kind of holds up, that holds firm, that is there. Now, what we find out actually in doing some historical studies on this is there was quite some debate and question as to how they should translate it. This is one of the more difficult words that they came to translate back in when they were doing this translation. They really weren't sure what word to put in here. And in reality, it ended up being more of a guess than anything else. They were really kind of guessing based on the context as to what word they should use. And it's, we think based on the next phrase, evidence, and the things he's talking about before that and after this, really this is kind of the idea of substance. And so that's what we're going to put in here. What I'm going to contend for you is that this is probably not a very good translation in this case, but hang on for that. Now, there's another use of substance, or another word, use of this Greek word. And that is, number two, is the essential or basic structure or nature of an entity. In this way, you would translate substantial nature, essence, actual being, or reality. Or it is also a plan that one devises for action, a plan or project, an undertaking, an endeavor. Well, that, talk about diversity for a word. I mean, we've gone from substance to essence to a plan or project. Well, that's kind of bizarre. And then there's another one that's a situation or a condition, a frame of mind, or confidence that comes from that. And that's where the translators get the word assurance. So they get this word confidence from this concept of situation or condition, frame of mind. I'm going to completely nix that one. And the reason I do is because there's no single example where in all of history we can find where the Greek word for this is translated in this sense. The only one possibly is in Hebrews 11:1. And if that's the only one, then probably not the best way to translate it, because you're kind of making that up. All right? And then there's this new one that they've discovered recently. Now, here's the funny thing. I'm doing this research on it. And all these people say there's a recent archaeological discovery. And I was thinking, well, how recent is it? I kept trying to dig and dig and dig, and everyone said recent. Everyone, recent, recent, recent. And then I found a guy in 1939 that said this. And I thought, okay, it's not so recent, but, you know, everything's relative. And so as opposed to, say, what the King James guys had in 1611, this is definitely recent. But I wasn't able to determine exactly the date of this thing, but my guess is it was around 39 or somewhere around there. And but what happened is, I've got some notes here I need to pull up. Oh, I left them in the car, so I won't be able to do that. I'll just read them from here. There were some documents that were unearthed that may shed some light on this term. In these documents, a woman named Dionysia, who is described as a woman of set jaw and grim determination. You'll see why I say that. She had a lower court proceeding over the issue of land ownership. Now, this is about 2,000 years ago this woman was living, around the time of Christ. She was not satisfied with the decision of the lower courts. She determined to take her case to a higher court in Alexandria. She sent her slave to that city with a legal document safely encased in a stone box. And on the way, the slave lost his life in a fire which destroyed the inn where he had put up for the night. And for 2,000 years, this box had been buried in the sand. And it was just recently uncovered, And the charred bones of the slave were there, and the stone box. And archaeologists have recently uncovered these remains, and in the box they found the legal documents. They read the note which this woman had sent to the judge in Alexandria, which said, "In order that my lord the judge may know that my appeal is just, I attach my hypostasis." And hypostasis is the word that's translated for us, substance or confidence. Now, that which she had attached to this note, she designated by the Greek word substance, and the attached document was translated and found to be the title deed to this piece of land, which she claimed as her own possession, the evidence of her ownership. And there's another case of archaeological evidence that's very similar to this, oddly enough, where they found a whole batch of these documents where someone was trying to prove ownership of something. And every one of these title deeds is what the documents read to be. The title of them was hypostasis, or title deed. And now I want you to think about this. This woman, by the way, may have never actually seen this property that she claimed to own, but yet she had a title deed to it that said, "This is mine." It's proof of what she had. And that's what we have as well. I could buy property somewhere. I could use a lawyer and a real estate agent, and I could buy some property in Timbuktu, right? Well, maybe not there. It's another country, but in Alaska. And so I could own this property and never ever visit it. A number of years ago, I went to one of these timeshare things where you go and visit them and you win something, you know, as a result of that. And I won property in Mexico. And they actually sent me a deed to this property, and it was mine for 15 years, because in Mexico you don't actually own land. You only become the deed holder, but it's for a temporary thing because no one in Mexico actually owns their own land. But anyhow, I had a deed for this land in Mexico that was mine for the next 15 years. It was on some beachfront property that had no access. Like, you couldn't get to it except by the sea or something. Anyhow, I'm sure it was worth a whole lot. I kept that deed, not. But the point is, in theory, I owned, so to speak, this land that I had never seen, much like this lady. But she was proving her ownership based on this thing. Now, the word then is used. Faith is the, and you may actually even strike the word substance out and put the word title deed there. Now, I'm not sure that's the best translation either, but think about what it's saying. Faith is the title deed of things hoped for. It is, I know what I am going to get, so much so that I have a title deed for it. It's been written down. I have the possession of that title deed, even though I've never actually seen that thing. And that's the point of what he's getting at here. It's no wonder the translators had a hard time with this word, because it's so diversely used. Substance is not entirely bad, because it is substantial, much like a title deed is, even though you don't actually have it. Now, when we use the word faith, a lot of times it's just used in this nebulous sense. That's certainly not the idea. But it's like we have a title deed for something we've never seen, but we know we're going to get. We have the legal right to it, and it's something that is there. It's of substance, it's of essence, and we can have confidence in that thing, so it's not entirely a bad translation either. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. So that we could also say then that faith is based on the proven substance of reality. Faith is evidential as well. Again, what we're trying to do is just trying to pull out elements of what it's telling us about faith. And it goes on then. By faith we understand that the worlds were set in order at God's command, so that the visible has its origin in the invisible. So how would we summarize this then? In other words, by this one phrase, what can we learn about faith that he tells us here? By faith we understand that the worlds were set in order at God's command, so that the visible had its origin in the invisible. Well, I'll ask you this. Were you there at creation? Some of you were close to right there, right? No, none of you were there. Do you understand how God made something out of nothing? Can you grasp that in any way, shape, or form? Let's say you believe in evolution. That's okay. Let's say you believe in evolution, that God used evolution to create the world. That's You know, I don't believe that. I believe that God created the world, and, well, recreated the world, actually, in 6 days. But that's another story. But anyhow, I believe that God created the world ex nihilo instantaneously. So I don't believe that. But let's say you did, that you want to hold to evolution, a Big Bang maybe, and that God used a Big Bang to make the world. Now, where did this stuff come from, the Big Bang? Do you understand that? Is there none of that you can possibly grasp? So even if you're just a hardened evolutionist and you don't even believe in God, you got to believe in something existing out there before that. None of that can you understand. Even that you have to do by faith. So there's certain things that we can't get to, but we know because He said it, we believe it. And I would summarize it this way. You don't have to know, you don't have to see, and you don't have to understand the means and the mechanisms of the outcome of this thing by faith. I don't know how it was done. I didn't see it. I don't understand the mechanisms or the means, but there's some outcome that comes as a result of this thing of faith that happens nonetheless. Now, by faith, Abel offered God a greater sacrifice than Cain. And through his faith, he was commended as righteous because God commended him for his offering. And through his faith, he still speaks, though he is dead. Now, what about this? What about what is he telling us here that we can glean from this that about faith? Or let me put it this way. What about faith can we gather specifically? What are the can you learn anything about the requirements for faith from this passage? Can you learn anything about the descriptions of faith? Are there anything about faith is, has, or does? Or how it operates? And ultimately, what the results of it are. Okay? Now, I'm gonna actually allow you to speak now. Isn't that nice of me? And I'm looking for your input. Any of these specific things, what is it that we can learn about faith from this specific passage?
Faith makes our sacrifices acceptable to God.
Say that again.
Faith makes our sacrifices acceptable to God.
Faith makes our sacrifices acceptable to God, okay? All right, anything else?
Even though Abel lost his life because of the sacrifice he offered, his faith still speaks. It's still a witness to us. Is that what?
Okay. So that would be under the category of results, maybe. Right? Is that right? Enduring results despite death, maybe. Is that a good way to say it?
Produces action.
Produces action? Okay. That's good. Whoops.
Faith pleases God.
Faith pleases God? Okay. I don't have a specific number of these, but is there any more?
When we have faith, righteousness is conveyed to
us. Say that one more time.
When we have faith, God's righteousness is conveyed to us.
It's conveyed to us. Okay? All right, that's good. Anything else?
Faith is about heart, not attitude.
Faith is about attitude? Okay.
Faith is about obedience.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you know, what's interesting about this is we aren't told specifically how he knew which was a better one. What intrigued me about it is, I wonder, In that society, in an agrarian and where you're living off the land and the produce of it, and you're also you have the animals that you're eating and you're raising up your own food. In other words, which one of those would be a greater sacrifice? I wonder, the killing an animal or animals or some produce. I would think it'd be the animals. What's that? They didn't eat yet? Oh, that's true. That's true. So. What?
Produce takes longer to produce. So, instead of sacrifice, because it takes longer.
Yeah. But if you kill an animal, then you don't get any more offspring from the animal. If you take some potatoes, then you still get potatoes.
But most herds, you always have young involved. I mean, you have various ages within the herd. Once you clear your crops, you've got to wait till next spring.
That's true.
So it could be a harsh time without food.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that we can necessarily say that one would be a greater sacrifice than another, but there's certainly a distinction there. And what I want to get to is this. Some of these qualities are enduring or universal, and some of them are not. Some of these characteristics. So we could say, which of these results are universal? Result, or which of these, not just the results, but which of these characteristics that we've listed here are universal, and which of them are just about this passage? Or in other words, are just an example. So what's important about that is that when you're reading through examples in the Bible, it doesn't mean that everything that specific example is necessarily supposed to apply to your life directly. I mean, obviously we aren't supposed to, kill an animal because Abel did. So that's not true, or whatever. So there are universal truths that are presented to us through examples sometimes, and sometimes they're just examples to prove up a universal truth, which is not necessarily inherent or described for us in the example. You follow me? So, in the New Testament, I just think of a clearer example, perhaps, and that is that in the book of Acts, they give us many different ways, or they give us portrayals of how a church is, or how churches are run. Home churches, for example. All you see pretty much in the New Testament are home churches. Now, some people will take that and say, as a result of how it is in the New Testament, that's how we should do it. Everyone should have a home church. I would say it's not bad to have a home church, but I'm not sure that that's what he's getting at there. Because people gathered in a home, well, they didn't have the means to have a building like we have. So there's nothing wrong with a building. There's nothing wrong with gathering in your home either. They have their own benefits and whatever. But you can't just take examples and say that example means this. You do this. Same thing here. So we want to look and see which of these things are universal truths, which of these things are just meant for us as an example. Now, what I had intended for us to do was to break out into groups and look at the next couple of passages. What I'll do is I'll leave that for the ladies next week. And so now you know what you're already going to be doing next week, and the guys don't have to worry about it. Guys don't like to talk in groups anyhow, so that'll work out nicely. All right. Now, what I do want to end on this, though, is this notion that, what he tells us is that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the Word of God. Now, each of these examples that will be listed for us in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, some of them will have clear universal truths that apply directly to us. Some of them won't. Some of them, we don't understand how they were acting in faith. In other words, you might read it and think, well, maybe faith here means Abel just guessed better than Cain. Well, that's not the case, because faith comes by hearing and hearing by the Word of God. Evidently, although it's not told to us specifically, evidently Abel had been told which is the better sacrifice. And you can kind of glean that when you actually read the passage back there talking about Cain and Abel as well, although it doesn't state it specifically as such. But so when you're reading through these things, your inference may be, well, man, I guess faith just means guessing and going out on a limb, or just believing that God's going to do whatever, That's not the case, but it does mean that when we know what to do based on His word and we don't do it, that is not faith and it's unpleasing to God. All right? Well, let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord, for your grace, for your love, for the superiority of your Son, whom you've given us an example to know that what holds true for the future will come true because He is faithful, and we can therefore and should enter into the holiest of holies through the blood of the covenant that He has given to us. We can trust you for our lives implicitly and explicitly in all areas, and I thank you for the examples that you've given us so that we can see that. We didn't deserve those examples, but we thank you for them. And pray that you'll help us to live for you and by you this coming week. In Jesus' name.